Hey, this is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, January 18th, 2018.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Happy to have you with us today. Congress has a Friday midnight deadline for a spending deal to prevent a government shutdown. And what looked last week like a fairly remote possibility is now significantly more real. Disagreements all over the Capitol. Republicans are at odds with themselves over spending. And now, after multiple bipartisan agreements on DACA, lawmakers are no closer to an agreement on immigration either. Now, many Democrats are insisting that a fix for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program be part of any spending deal. This is about leverage. It's also about a crucial part of the Democratic voting base that lawmakers do not want to disappoint. But will that be enough to push Congress to avoid a government shutdown? Rachel Bade is here, congressional reporter for Politico. Rachel, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Look, Rachel, Republicans in the House introduced a new spending bill last night. It funds the government for 4 weeks. This is basically the kick the can scenario that you told us on Monday when you were here was probably coming. A shutdown is less than 2 days away. What's the state of play here?
Yeah, so it sounds like House Republican leaders are still whipping this. They do not currently have the 215 votes they need to pass this today. Democrats are withholding their votes because there is no solution for the Dreamers. And so they're basically forced to rely on Republicans. And this is a very divided conference that very rarely agrees. So they are still whipping that. Now, I have a Republican source who told me this morning that they think this is going to pass by, quote, flying by the skin of their teeth. And it sounds like even if it passes the House, though, the bigger issue is now looking like it could be the Senate. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has a bunch of people falling off who were supportive of the last short-term stopgap spending bill they passed in December. Lindsey Graham, in particular, came out yesterday and said, "No more. I'm not going to keep funding the government on a temporary basis." He says it hurts the military, and GOP leaders need to get serious about striking a DACA deal and thus a long-term budget deal with Democrats, which he doesn't think they are right now.
So it sounds like the bottom line here is unless Republicans can pass spending deals all by themselves with no Democrats, which is getting increasingly difficult, they have to ask Democrats for votes. And if you have to ask Democrats for votes, you have to solve DACA, right?
That's exactly right. In the House in particular, they have majority rules. So technically, Republicans could pass this without any Democrats in the House. However, it's very difficult because conservatives don't like to vote for these things. They think the government funding is too high to begin with. And then you have defense hawks who don't like to do temporary funding bills because they say it hurts the military. And we've heard a lot of defense hawks talking recently in the past 24 to 48 hours about troop deaths that occurred during drilling accidents, saying there were more accidents for folks who were training here in the United States than actually in combat last year. And this they attribute to irresponsible government in terms of not funding the military. So that becomes hard over in the House. Speaker Paul Ryan has been trying to entice some Democrats to vote for this thing in the House by adding 6 years worth of, they call it CHIP funding. It's basically money for a very popular children's health insurance program that is aimed specifically at low-income kids. It's very bipartisan, and Democrats do not like to vote against it. And so there are some Democrats who are not happy that they're going to have to vote against this in the House, but they think they've got to do this if they want to leverage their votes to try to get a DACA solution.
Now, Rachel, you mentioned CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. We've been covering it like crazy on this show. It's extremely popular. That program has expired for months. 9 million kids use that program. Paul Ryan used CHIP funding as a sweetener. You just mentioned it. Hey, Democrats, vote for this thing. Don't hold DACA hostage to children's health care. I saw a tweet this morning from the president that shocked me, Rachel. The president of the United States said that CHIP should not be part of a short-term spending deal. It should only be part of a long-term spending deal. The bottom line there is he undermined the negotiating position of the House GOP leadership. I couldn't believe it.
Not a surprise in Trump's Washington. The president does this on a regular basis to Hill Republican leadership. I am not sure who gave President Trump this advice, but Speaker Ryan was adamant that this should be on a temporary CR to try to win Democrats. My guess is that Republicans have come to terms with the fact that even 6 years worth of this funding is not necessarily going to buy them any Democratic help in the House. And so perhaps there are some people who are now squawking about that and saying, well, let's take it off and try to use it to get them to back a long-term spending solution. But again, Democrats are showing that they are willing to hold the line, at least in the House, and not back anything in terms of government funding until they figure out what they're going to do with DACA and come up with an immigration deal. I'm curious to see what happens in the Senate, because unlike the House, the Senate actually has to have 9 Senate Democrats to pass any funding bill, even a short-term one. And before, we had, I think, 17 Democrats who voted for the last temporary funding bill in the Senate in December, and one independent that caucuses with the Democrats, so technically 18. But now these same folks who backed it in December are saying they might not vote for a temporary spending bill again. And so those are the Democrats to really watch in the Senate, because they could really cause a headache for McConnell.
Well, I want to talk about the Senate a little bit more, but this tweet from the president this morning, Rachel, I guess surprised me more than it surprised you. Yes, he undermines the House Republican leadership, the congressional Republican leadership, an awful lot. But look, a government shutdown is an ugly, ugly political exercise. If there's going to be a shutdown, the only way to win is to convince the public that the other side is to blame. And by taking Chip off the table, or at least saying he wants to, didn't the president damage Paul Ryan's ability to blame Democrats if an increasingly likely shutdown happens?
I think that he certainly scrambled Paul Ryan's schedule and plan. There's no doubt about that. I think that the president, regardless of this, is going to try to blame Democrats if there is a shutdown by saying specifically that they won't fund the government because they want a solution for people who came here illegally. That's going to be the number one line Republicans use over and over again if this shuts down. And they're going to, meanwhile, try to say the military is having serious issues right now and a shutdown hurts the military. So I'm already hearing people like Warren Davidson, a conservative from Ohio, say Democrats are prioritizing 800,000 undocumented immigrants at the expense of our troops. And I expect that that's going to be, you know, one of their top talking points. There's going to be plenty of finger pointing.
Well, sure. I mean, a government shutdown essentially is about finger pointing and assigning blame. It's a gross exercise, but we may be about to see how this latest Congress and this president are going to go through it. Rachel, let's talk about the pressures and the priorities of Democrats in the Senate. You said if a shutdown's to be avoided, they're going to need 9 Democrats to come over. What kinds of pressures are Democrats under, not only from activist groups who want a solution to DACA, but also for their 2018 reelection prospects? There's a lot of competing priorities here, competing for Democratic votes.
That's a great question. So I was just talking to a colleague before this interview about immigration groups on the outside, progressive immigration groups who are pushing for a Dreamer solution as soon as possible. They are getting giddy right now because they feel like something has shifted in the Senate, and that now, whereas a lot of Senate Democrats were sort of loath to vote against government funding in to try to get an immigration solution, now they're seeing some people say they want to hold the line. So activists on the outside have been putting pressure on Democratic leaders, saying you need to block anything until we get this fixed. Now it actually seems like it might happen. As for 2018, you're right. There are a lot of different factors at play here. You have some Democrats who are from swing states, more conservative Democrats, who perhaps don't want to vote against a government funding bill, because if they are accused of shutting the government down in more moderate states, it doesn't necessarily play well. So they are also watching their backs on that. However, I think you're going to have those Democrats, they're going to be making a calculation. Do their constituents, are they going to blame them for shutting down the government, or are they going to blame them for not getting a solution for Dreamers? And right now they're having to make this choice about which is better for the country, but also better for their reelection prospects.
I mean, if you're in a party that demands a stand up to Trump, be defiant to Trump, and support progressive immigration policy. That's really the Democratic base. But you're from a state that Donald Trump won, and the message on a government shutdown might be that you shut down the government to defend illegal immigrants. You're a Democrat, I don't know, running in Missouri. Not an easy choice.
Yeah. Heidi Heitkamp, she's another one to watch. President Trump in particular has, I think he went out there with her and talked a little bit about tax reform, trying to pressure her to vote for the tax bill. And that's because in her state, there are a lot of Republican voters. And so she's got to worry about those voters, too, when she's reelected. She's a Democrat, but, you know, it's a more centrist state. So President Trump has pull there.
And Heidi Heitkamp is from where?
North Dakota.
Yeah, right, where President Trump
and
won.
So, exactly. So he has pull there. He can go there and say, listen, she shut the government down over undocumented immigrants, and that would be a problem for her.
Well, Rachel, I'm going to let you go in just about a minute, but you were here on Monday. You said that you thought the likely scenario here was a kick the can scenario for about a month. It looks like that's probably true, or at least they want it to be true, but that a shutdown probably wouldn't happen. Are you feeling as confident now as you were on Monday that a shutdown would be avoided here?
I am actually not, I'll be honest. I was pretty certain, you know, we were talking to Senate Democrats who were not willing to hold the line and did not want a shutdown. Right now, we only hear one Senate Democrat, Joe Manchin, who says he's going to continue to vote to fund the government regardless of a solution for Dreamers. That's one that is not going to keep the government open. And so we might be here through the weekend, potentially next week. All things are on the table at this point.
All things are on the table. Children's health care, at least it was, DACA, spending, and the election prospects of Republicans and Democrats in the Trump era. Rachel Bade, congressional reporter for Politico. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as lawmakers battle it out over immigration policy in Washington, let's move to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and one slice of the immigration story here that's playing out. Nearly a year ago, we told you how local leaders are trying to provide a welcoming atmosphere for immigrants. Well, now there's a new wrinkle in this story, a controversial plan to use taxpayer money for legal help for non-citizens facing deportation. Minnesota Public Radio's Brant Williams is here. Hi, Brant.
Hi, Todd.
Well, Brant, ICE enforcement seems to be on the rise in Minneapolis and Hennepin County there. What do the numbers look like, and what's the county been doing?
Well, yeah, there has been an increase in ICE arrests here in this region. The latest stats that we have show that there's been about a tripling of people who have been arrested who have no criminal convictions compared to the previous year in 2016. Of course, this area includes Minnesota, Iowa, the Dakotas, and Nebraska. The total number of those arrests went from 2,500 in 2016 to over 4,100 in 2017. What's been happening is a number of activists who support the rights of non-citizens who are here in Minnesota, they went to the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners late last year to advocate for some help for those people. And so I sat in and listened on a public hearing where a lot of these folks came to tell commissioners what they felt needed to be done.
Well, Brant, what was the genesis of this? There was a union organizer named Luciano Morales who was detained and deported, and there have been a lot of other issues as well.
That's correct. Morales is one of several high-profile cases of non-citizens who've been deported out of Hennepin County. There was a public hearing held last November in front of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. There was a number of activists who spoke about Morales and others. There was a woman named Maria Edith Silva. She came to tell commissioners that Morales was a union organizer and he was pulled over in a traffic stop and he was deported. And the family had to come up with about $3,000 of bail money. And here's what she had to say.
Pagaron el dinero y cuando supuestamente la liberación.
They paid this money, the $3,000, and when they supposedly he was being liberated in the door of the jail, ICE was waiting for him.
And of course, that was a translator speaking for Silva in front of the county board. She said she also mentioned that the family spent this money for bail and Morales was deported and the family never got the bail money back.
Were they entitled to it?
Well, people were concerned because that money was hard to come by in the first place. And the fact that this man was taken just as he was leaving jail and then taken to an immigration holding center and then deported, didn't give them a chance to take any other action to help him stay in the country.
So, Brent, some of these activists have gone to the county looking for help. You mentioned that. How has the county responded?
Well, so there has been there was a couple measures that were passed by the county board. One of them was to create a legal defense fund, which would help people who are in the Hennepin County Jail, non-citizens who are in danger of being deported. That's a $250,000 fund, which will provide free legal assistance for these folks. The county also dedicated about $25,000 to create some paper materials that would be distributed inside the jail for the folks to let them know what their legal rights are. Now, these were created by a Hennepin County commissioner named Marion Green. She said that the need is probably far greater than what's provided for in this in the amendments, but she said it should help. And here's what she had to say about that.
I can't say to my communities, you're safe here. And so what I'd like to do is say there's some recompense, and this is really a small amount of recompense, but it's something.
But still, Brent, this is a remarkable state of affairs, a local community responding with taxpayer money to basically counteract some of the effects of federal immigration enforcement.
Yeah, and it wasn't popular with all of the commissioners. It narrowly passed. And in particular, there was one commissioner, Commissioner Jeff Johnson, who is also a candidate for governor this year in Minnesota, said that he was open to discussing immigration, but he just wasn't comfortable voting for this type of measure.
My gut reaction to this is having taxpayers pay to defend someone who's here illegally is problematic.
Well, that's one candidate for governor and a Hennepin County commissioner who's unhappy with it. Has anyone heard from the feds?
No, this is something that, as we know, that folks who are in the immigration system, if you're taken to a detention center in federal immigration center, you don't have a legal right to representation. So this is all like a lot of grassroots and local cities in as we see now, Hennepin County, that have been trying to pool money to provide some type of legal assistance.
Well, the legal defense money is there, as remarkable as it is. Do the activists who came to the county in the first place think the funds will help?
Yeah, they said it's a good start. And one of these activists, her name is Catalina Morales. She's with a group called Isaiah. She came to speak at this public hearing in front of the county board. Isaiah is one of a number of faith-based groups who try to help immigrants and other and low-wage workers, and people are having a hard time negotiating in the community. And she came to say that this is it's a good start, but her organization has been trying to raise money, but there's an increased need for help for these folks. And this is what Catalina had to say about that.
We have created this great sanctuary network that has over 50 congregations that are supporting folks. So we've been fundraising for individuals, we've been fundraising for bail, but the congregations in the community cannot afford to not only bail people out of jail and then bail them out of immigration and then pay their lawyers. This is an effect that's getting people dug deeper into a hole of poverty as well.
And Morales added that, you know, this is particularly a problem for families of folks who are being detained and deported, because a lot of times these people are the breadwinners in these families. They're workers. They're the ones who are providing for their families, and they are the ones who are being arrested and sometimes being deported.
Well, Brent, you described the debate that went on in the Hennepin County Commissioners Council meeting. What about the wider group of voters and constituents in Minneapolis and Hennepin County? What do they have to say about their taxpayer money being used for legal defense for undocumented immigrants?
Well, I'll tell you, the people that have showed up for public hearings at the county and discussions at the city of Minneapolis, which is one of about 45 cities inside of Hennepin County, people are generally supportive of helping folks who need help defending themselves against action taken by the federal government. However, in the case of Jeff Johnson and others who are outside of the central cities, tend to have a little bit more skepticism about the government's role in doing something that these non-citizens don't necessarily have a legal right to, that type of help. This discussion is probably going to keep going as more and more cities in Hennepin County have their own debates about whether or not they should devote taxpayer dollars to help these people defend themselves against immigration charges.
Brent Williams, reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks, Brent.
You're welcome, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Our ongoing coverage now of Yemen, where nearly 3 years of war have left the country struggling with the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. More than 22 million people now are in need of humanitarian aid, and 400,000 children are severely malnourished. Aid groups that provide urgently needed food and supplies to the people of Yemen have relied on the port of Hodeidah to do that, but a Saudi-led military blockade blocked that port last year and then only reopened it again in December for a limited time after intense international pressure. Well, now that port could be closed again as soon as this Friday. Stephen Anderson is the country director for the UN World Food Program in Yemen. He joins me now from Amman, Jordan. Stephen Anderson, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Stephen, how critical is this port of Hodeidah to your work in Yemen? Can you use other ports? Have you been using other ports?
We have been using all ports as much as possible. Yemen, even before the conflict and the crisis, had been importing over 90% of its food. So having access by ports is absolutely critical. And the port of Hodeidah accounts for about 70% of imported cargo. For us, as a relief agency, the World Food Program, about 5 million people who we need to get food to desperately every single month are best served from the port of Hodeidah. We use also the port of Aden in the south, but that's quite a bit further afield. It's more costly and it takes more time to get food and other supplies up from there. And also you cross conflict zones.
So this is a critical choke point, clearly, for the aid that you and other organizations provide. What do we know about actual plans to close the port and whether it will be closed by the Saudis and their war coalition on Friday?
We're not quite sure at this stage. We have been lobbying intensely ever since the ports were closed in early November. When there was this restrictions put in place, we immediately sounded the alarm that this would directly impact the lives of millions of people who require humanitarian assistance. Also, of course, there's serious medical issues in Yemen. It's had the world's worst cholera outbreak last year. And also, diphtheria is also spreading. We think this humanitarian situation, it's all interlinked, unfortunately. And what I'm happy to report is that thanks to all of our appeals, it seems that the international community has very much heeded them and amplified them. And we have had for the last month the ports all reopening. And this has been extremely important, not only for the humanitarian agencies, but critically also for commercial cargo. The World Food Program is serving about one quarter of the population, about 7 million people every single month. These are the people who are, we consider to be closest to famine-like conditions. You know, the people we're not serving, they depend heavily on markets, and markets depend on commercial food imports and fuel. Fuel is absolutely critical, ensuring that fuel gets in, because fuel not only allows trucks to move, it allows hospitals to be run. When we saw the price of fuel spiking, immediately that this was also driving up the prices of food and other necessities. And so that's really hurting people who are really struggling. Almost all the civil servants, particularly in the northern part of Yemen, for more than a year and 3 months, they haven't been receiving their salaries. And that affects almost 8 or 9 million people if you count their families together with them.
Stephen Anderson, country director for the UN World Food Program in Yemen. Stephen, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
Now to the Rohingya crisis along the Bangladesh border, where there are 750,000 refugees and growing. Well, earlier this week, the Bangladesh and Myanmar governments reached an agreement to start sending Rohingya refugees back to Myanmar in a plan that could begin as early as next week. Eric Schwartz is president of Refugees International, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees and Migration. He says moving refugees now is dangerously premature, even deadly.
these two governments have apparently reached this agreement in principle. But well-thinking people and well-thinking governments around the world really need to ensure that this does not go forward. There are so many prerequisites that have to be put in place before this kind of a return process begins. You need guarantees of voluntariness. You need monitoring upon return to ensure that people are not going to be subject to continued abuses. You need a specific guarantee that the rights of Rohingya will be respected, that their freedom of movement will be respected, that they will receive compensation for lost land, that they will be granted civil and political rights. None of those issues were discussed in the agreement that was reached on the 16th.
None of those issues at all, including international monitoring. Thousands of people ostensibly start going back to Myanmar, and the international community doesn't have eyes on it?
Of course. And there would have to be a presence on the ground in Rakhine State. And in addition, in terms of the development of this plan, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees should be deeply involved, and to all appearances, UNHCR was not involved. We're in a situation now where not even the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar, Yang Hee Lee, is permitted into the country. She's not. And so the idea that we should be moving forward, or these governments should be moving forward on a repatriation plan, is kind of ridiculous. It's actually horrific.
Let's try to get into the motivations of these two countries to cut a deal just between themselves on these hundreds of thousands of refugees. I suppose from Bangladesh's perspective, the immediate incentive is understandable. They have refugees in their country, and they'd like them out.
I think that's right. I think that as magnanimous as Sheikh Hasina has been in her statements about the Rohingya, that the government there would much prefer the vast majority of that population to be on the other side of the border. So those pressures are very much at play. But the government of Bangladesh should be constrained by the dictates of international refugee law, which says you do not return somebody to a place where they are at risk of suffering persecution. And if you don't think Rohingya are at risk of suffering persecution upon return to Myanmar, then you haven't been following events in that part of the world over the past many months.
Eric, I don't want to be hyperbolic about the analogy here. You'll correct me if I am. There is an infamous story from the eve of World War II, the St. Louis. A ship that sailed from Germany toward the United States was famously turned back with a boatload of 900 Jews to be left to their fate within Nazi Germany. Am I overshooting it in terms of making an analogy?
Of course you're not. Hundreds of those who were returned perished in the Holocaust. And that is, you know, for many of us who are in this field of work, the memory of the St. Louis is a kind of a motivating factor for everything that we do.
Is there time for the international community to use both its legal means and its political pressure on Bangladesh, and maybe to a lesser extent Myanmar in this case, to slow things down and get some more controls on this relocation plan?
Oh, of course there is. Of course there's time. There is a great opportunity for governments of the world to exert pressure on the government of Bangladesh not to move forward on this precipitously. The tougher issue is, you know, how do you ultimately solve this challenge? How do you address this challenge of hundreds of thousands of refugees in Bangladesh? There, the answers are much more elusive. How do you have accountability for the terrible abuses that took place in Rakhine State by the authorities in Myanmar, by the military? How do you get the kinds of safeguards you need to permit return? Those are the tough questions, but you don't answer those tough questions by ignoring them.
Eric Schwartz, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Eric Schwartz is president of Refugees International. The United States military and its commander, President Trump, are busy rethinking America's nuclear weapons strategy and the circumstances where the president would order a strike. Now, here's President Obama 9 years ago.
I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
President Trump, for his part, hasn't talked much about America's nuclear arsenal since getting elected, but here he was during the campaign.
First of all, you don't want to say take everything off the table.
No, just
you're
nuclear.
A bad negotiator if you do
just
that.
Just nuclear.
Look, nuclear should be off the table. But would there be a time when it could be used? Possibly. Okay,
President Trump during the campaign there. Now, the president reportedly told his advisors over the summer that he wanted a return to Cold War levels of nuclear weapons, essentially a tenfold increase in the American arsenal. Now, the president was apparently talked down by his aides and has since denied that remark. But what's on the table and what's off with America's nuclear arsenal is really the point of the Nuclear Posture Review. The Pentagon has drafted its review, and it now sits in the White House waiting for President Trump's approval. It calls for the development of smaller, lower-yield nuclear weapons, and it would also expand the circumstances under which the president might order a nuclear strike. Michelle Flournoy is here with me now. She served as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the first Obama administration and is now Managing Director of West Exec Advisors. Michelle Flournoy, thanks for being here.
It's good to be with you.
Well, the Nuclear Posture Review gets updated pretty much every time we get a new president, so this memo is no different in that respect. But when you read the document this time, how much of a policy shift do you see between the Obama administration and the Trump administration when it comes to America's nuclear arsenal and whether we would ever use it?
I think there are a couple of very important policy shifts that we've seen in this draft document. We should remember that it's still in draft, but if we take this as an indication of the administration's intent, two big things that I'd cite. The first is, while it uses very similar language about when we would use nuclear weapons, it interprets that language differently. So usually the document says something like the United States would only consider using nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances to defend vital interests of the U.S., our allies, our partners. But what this document does is it reinterprets what extreme circumstances are. In the past, most administrations, Bush, Obama, have said extreme circumstances means somebody else has used a nuclear weapon or the U.S. has suffered a catastrophic attack, like a biological weapons attack, with millions of people affected. Here, they've seemed to broaden that definition to include things like large cyber attacks on our infrastructure or on our nuclear forces or command and control. So they seem to be opening up the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons in a broader set of circumstances.
Lots of policymakers, as you know, Michelle Flournoy, have been looking for a different incentive structure when it comes to cyber attacks that aren't necessarily on the internet, so that other countries, other actors, independent groups know that a cyber attack would be met with a severe response. Does this go to that aim, and does it strike you as appropriate or balanced?
You know, I think the fact that we have a nuclear arsenal is always in the background of any adversary's minds if they're launching a major attack on the United States, that those tools are already there. But I think to openly talk about nuclear use against cyber attacks, you open that up to become a new norm, you know, internationally, for others to contemplate the same thing. I'd much rather see an effort to try to negotiate a set of international norms that says, we're not going to attack each other's infrastructure with cyber, and that's a sort of no-go zone, almost like an arms control regime in the cyber domain. So I think lowering the nuclear threshold is not the right response. There are other ways to deal with the cyber threat problem.
So how's the world changed then, Michelle Flournoy, from the Cold War? I mean, many Americans still identify the nuclear arsenal with the Cold War, the mutually assured destruction between Russia and the United States. Of course, China's on the rise and they have a large arsenal as well. But the world now is full of threats of terror groups and independent actors and rogue countries like North Korea. Does the big Cold War nuclear arsenal still apply in today's world? How do planners look at that?
Well, again, it's always in the background as the ultimate form of deterrence. But for the last decade, the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. strategy has been shrinking because we're facing a very different world. And the size of the arsenal has come down by about, 85% since the height of the Cold War. Recent presidents have been more concerned about the risk of nuclear materials falling into the hands of terrorists or rogue states. And so they've put an emphasis on policing up nuclear materials that's weapons usable and or shoring up the nonproliferation regime. So this is sort of a going back to the future. I mean, you know, it's a backward looking approach in my view. We have to remember all of this costs money, and the full modernization that's described in the Nuclear Posture Review, it comes in at well over $1.2 trillion of investment over 30 years. I just think there are better things to be spending our defense dollars on to give a president real options for preventing conflict, deterring conflict, and if we have to, prevailing in conflict.
Before we let you go, Michelle Flournoy, there were reports earlier in the administration over the summer that when the president was briefed on the size and the capabilities of the arsenal, that he didn't like what he saw from the Obama administration with the size of the arsenal being reduced. He said he wanted it increased tenfold, or he wanted it to look like a Cold War arsenal. It seems like senior advisors sort of talked him down from that position. The White House has denied it. But you talk to people around town. I know how well connected you are. Did you hear that too through your friends? And even if you don't want to tell me that, what does it tell you about the attitude of this administration toward nuclear weapons?
What I understand is that the president made that comment looking at a chart that showed the dramatic reduction in the U.S. nuclear arsenal since the peak of the Cold War. And he came to that with a, you know, bigger must be better kind of attitude. Well, that's not the case. One of the things that's been a real achievement of many administrations, Republican and Democrat, has been steadily pursuing nuclear arms control to reduce the nuclear danger, bringing arsenals down the world over, including Russia. So I just think he came to it with a mindset, not knowing a lot about the nuclear issue, unfortunately. And again, one of the things that's missing in this NPR is a focus on nuclear diplomacy. How are we going to get to our goals of reducing the dangers, reducing arsenals, reducing the role of nuclear weapons? What's the strategy there? There's virtually no discussion of the arms control component of U.S. nuclear policy in this document.
Michelle Flournoy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Michelle Flournoy is Managing Director of West Exec Advisors. She was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Obama administration. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's great to have you with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. When it comes to medical science, bigger is better. The more people you can get into your experiment, the more it tells you about how the world really works. Well, that's the reason why the National Institutes of Health is now looking for 1 million Americans to donate their genetic and health information this spring. The initiative is called All of Us. The idea here is to match genetic data with lifestyle and health data to come up with a finely detailed picture of what affects Americans' health and where the cures are.
If you get sick and you need to take a drug, 10 years from now, this study will teach us what's the right dose of the right drug for you, as opposed to a one-size-fits-all approach to prescription.
That's NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, the driving force behind the Human Genome Project at NIH. Well, now the agency wants the world's largest genetic library, and the idea is to help focus medicine more sharply than ever. Dr. Collins, thanks for being here. DNA, lifestyle, and environmental information on 1 million Americans. It's a massive undertaking. Why so big?
If you really want to understand what are the factors that play out in terms of maintaining good health or how best to manage chronic illness if it strikes, you need very large amounts of data, and lots of people participating in a study of that sort is how we could get there. And that both gives us the power to really understand what the factors are that play out in health or illness, but also how we can understand differences between people so that we might be able to get beyond a one-size-fits-all approach to health maintenance into something that's more individualized. So it's time to move what has been small-scale efforts, at least in this instance, up to an unprecedented scale of 1 million people. And we're going to learn things from this that will transform our understanding of medicine.
So what would this database actually consist of? What are you asking of people?
So we'll ask our participants, and they're going to be full partners in all the decisions that happen about their data and what happens to it and how much they want to see and where it goes. We would ask them to fill out a whole lot of questionnaires about their lifestyle, their health behaviors, their diet, their exercise plans. We'll ask them to give a blood sample and a urine sample, The blood sample will be used to do a lot of laboratory measurements, including looking at their DNA to look at hereditary factors. And we'll ask them to make their electronic health records available. All of this anonymized before it goes into a central database where researchers can get access to it to protect their privacy. But we do want to have this kind of very comprehensive understanding of what's happening to these people. And not just one snapshot, but this is going to be over time. People who participate, we hope, will stay involved in this program for many years to come.
So, Francis Collins, talk a little bit about the scientific goals here, and let's try to get specific. You already mentioned that big sample sizes are good. A group of a million people tells you a lot more than a group of 1,000. I get that. But let's say, you know, if we already know that high cholesterol, mostly from diet, increases the risk of heart disease, and we sort of know that, what more could we learn about that public health problem from a database like this?
Well, we know that not everybody with the same level of cholesterol ends up with the same heart disease risk. There must be other subtleties that are going on there. We haven't had the ability to take that apart. With very large numbers of people where we also know about their diet plans, their exercise plans, other kinds of laboratory measures, their DNA. We'll even outfit many of these people with wearable sensors like Fitbits that they can walk around with to keep track of their daily activity. We should be able to say, hey, you know, your cholesterol, although it looks like it's probably okay in the normal range, you're actually somebody who might need an intervention anyway because of these other risk factors. Trying to take this from where it has been, which is pretty much one size fits all, to something that's more individualized. And with large numbers, we should be able to do that.
Well, Dr. Collins, I can hear you in your answers promoting transparency and privacy here at the outset. And you all seem to sense the risk here perceived by the public. Will convincing Americans to give over their genetic samples with a lot of other information about their lives to the government be an impediment here? I know that you're telegraphing a lot of transparency and a lot of buy-in, but people might look at this sideways and see that it's information they don't necessarily want to give, even if they believe in good science.
I totally understand that, and I would not want anybody to sign up for this study without looking at exactly how we're planning to maintain the security of the system. That'll be part of the consent process, and if people simply aren't comfortable with that, well, then they simply should decide not to take part, and many people will feel that way. But from our early efforts here, and we've been doing a beta test here, a lot of people still see this as something they want to take part of. They understand that risks are there. They understand that we're doing everything possible to protect the security of the system. And we're stripping off all of the identifiers that give you name and address and birth date and social security number and all that stuff, so that what's in the database that researchers will work with will not say who these people are. Still, they understand that there are potential risks there of identification. And yet, we now have more than 10,000 people in our test of this who have signed up enthusiastically to say, I want to take part. This is an adventure I want to be part of. And they're going to get a lot of information back about themselves, which could be quite valuable for their own healthcare.
So, Dr. Collins, I spent a lot of years covering your agency and the FDA, and clinical research has suffered greatly from a lack of ethnic and sex diversity, just in the pool of people who are studied and the types of results you can get. So how will this project help?
We have an explicit goal of enrolling in this group of a million people, at least half of them that are traditionally underrepresented. And that includes racial and ethnic groups that tend not to be invited to participate in research or who have concerns about it. It includes people from different socioeconomic status. We want to be sure we're reaching out to those who maybe otherwise wouldn't have heard about a study of this sort. That includes geographic diversity. That includes getting people in rural areas who often don't participate in research. We're very determined. Watch us on this one. This is going to be a very different model.
All right. So, Dr. Collins, let's jump ahead 10 years. The data and the samples have all been collected. Research groups have applied to access the data and do lots of research. I won't ask you to guess at a specific discovery, but how will we know that this massive effort has been a success? What kinds of advancements, what kinds of knowledge, when you and I talk in 10 years, which I'm sure we will let us know that this was all worthwhile?
The way in which in 10 years people will be given advice about how to stay healthy will be profoundly affected by this. We will understand the factors involving environmental exposures, diet, exercise, health behaviors, and genetics in ways that we currently don't. And so when you go to your doc in a decade, that should influence profoundly the kind of recommendation you're given about how to stay healthy. If you get sick and you need to take a drug, 10 years from now, this study will teach us what's the right dose of the right drug for you, as opposed to a one-size-fits-all approach to prescriptions, which right now is what we have. And we know that doesn't always turn out well. That's going to be a profound part of this. And if you get a chronic illness, let's say you come down with diabetes, this study will allow us, because there will be tens of thousands of diabetics in the study, how best to manage that. And there will probably be ways using cell phone technology and maybe an artificial pancreas that will be worked out over the course of that decade that will be available to you, and that the All of Us study will have helped prove how they work in the real world in a very diverse population. So it's going to have a big effect.
All right, Francis Collins, I'm going to let you go. Before I do, look, part of your job is to get money from Congress for all of the programs that are important at NIH. They are toying with yet another four-week CR right now. Directors of NIH and CDC hate this kind of thing. What does it mean for you and your agency to see more continuing resolutions, more stopgap spending measures instead of a spending agreement with domestic spending versus defense spending on Capitol Hill?
Congress has been very supportive of NIH, especially in the last couple of years. And if we get to the point of a budget for this current fiscal year, the indications are that it will also be very supportive. But as the weeks click by here and we're trying to make plans about where to make these investments, it's very difficult not to know what actually the budget is going to be. So I hope pretty soon we get past what have been a serious set of log jams and make some decisions.
Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Collins, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Well, NIH wants to hear from you, and of course, we do too. Have you ever done genetic testing to uncover health risks? From Deer Park, New York, I have, and I'm waiting on the results. I have no family medical history because I was adopted at a time in New York when closed adoptions were legal. I want this information for my own sake and for that of my biological children.
Hi, my name is Julie from Erie, Colorado. Yes, I have done genetic testing. I'm a scientist and so want to make health decisions for me and my children based on data.
Are you excited for what your genetics could have to tell you? Are you ready, maybe, for some of the bad news you might get? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation, as always, on our Facebook page. This is The Takeaway.